accession number 18463, reel 36.
Dunbar, reel 36.
Anyway, we're halfway through my tour, and we've now got to change the sentries. I've got no trouble with the two that are patrolling around Company HQ area, because it's an open area, and they are just toing and froing. But I haven't seen anything of the other two that are over the other side there. So we now start to go around. I send them off to try and rouse their chaps up, which they do, and the two come over. I'm not supposed to leave this wretched post, but I've lost two people. I've completely lost them over the other side there. And what's more, I don't know where they know where the people are. They've got to wake up. Well, I don't know. And of course, the old thing happens. You start to wake people up, and they say, it's not me, you know, because they're not going to get up. And now you don't know which of the pair it is, and oh, the terrible kerfuffle going on here in the middle of the night. Anyway, I'm stuck by this wretched post, and I realise this is hopeless. I've got to go and find the other two guys. So I leave me post, whatever the orders are from the company commander. I go off, and I find them, and they're two good lads. They're on the far side, because they said, well, look, it's a bit dark over here. We thought we'd better stay over here and cover this area whilst you're in the middle there, you know, in case somebody comes in over the fence. And we're having a brief little chat. And I suddenly hear a voice shouting out, Guard Commander! Guard Commander! So I go running back, and Major Allen's come back, with accompanied by Chris Lawrence. And I would suggest they probably had a couple of bevies over before they came back. And he's not very pleased. So, because there's no Guard Commander standing at this wretched post. And I'm the Guard Commander. So I raced up to him and said to him, oh, sorry, sir. I'm the Guard Commander. Sorry, I had to go off and get this. Who? I said, I'm the Guard Commander. I don't want you. What are you doing on guard? I said, well, CSM's put me on guard, you know. Get the CSM. So I now have to go and find the CSM. I haven't got a clue where he is. And I eventually find him in a bell tent with the MTO, and they're halfway through a bottle of whiskey and playing cards. So I said to him, you better come, so the company commander's not too pleased about things. So he's pulling on his equipment and rubbing his little short tubby. Never should have been. He'd been on TA for a good many years, then sent out to Korea, and he had his war service, obviously. And he just wasn't fit, poor man. I mean, it was a crime to send people like that to Korea. Anyway, he trundles over, and the company commander said to him, where's the guard commander? He said, there he is, sir. Call back. Right. Why have you put one of my platoon commanders on guard? And he said, but his name came up on the roster, sir. The next thing you'll be doing, he said, is putting Mr. Lawrence or me on guard. Get it changed. And I said to him, well, I don't mind, so I'll carry on till the next guard comes on. Get to your bed, Corporal, he said, and not another word out of you. So I'm sent off to my bed, and I'm now not only I've upset the company commander, the CSM's not pleasing me, because obviously he's getting a terrible rocket for putting a platoon commander on guard, and I could see that my days were going to be numbered. Anyway, had a good night. Following morning, there's an O group, and the company commander said to me, after the O group dismisses, you stay here. I thought, well, this is it. I'm going to be in trouble all round here. I'm trying to avoid the CSM. I don't want him to give me a rocket as well. Anyway, he said, look, I'm going over to battalion, and I've decided to disband 6th Platoon and form an assault section. You'll be the section commander, and you can pick who you want. I want 10 men, a 10-man section. I mean, we've never had 10-man sections ever since we've been there, I don't think. And you can pick any NCO you like for your 2IC. So I was ever so disappointed, really, for the platoon to be disbanded. But I hid it and said, well, I understand, so, you know. And he wants to spread the others around the other two platoons to pad them out a little bit, because they're all pretty thin on the ground. Anyway, I go back and tell the lads, and I was a surprise, because they all wanted to get in this assault section. I mean, it's not a very pleasant sounding name, assault, is it really? Anyway, Bill came forward and said, I must be the 2IC. And I said, well, no, come on. If you go off, you might get promotion to full corporal and, you know, in another platoon, but you won't get it here. No, he insisted, and I was surprised at that as well. So myself and Bill, I took 7 section, and I padded them out with some of the old faithfuls who'd come out from Hong Kong. And we let the new lads, left them in a group. We then moved over to where Company HQ was and just sat around there waiting for the rest of the day, as it happened. We're on central cooking, so there's no sea rattles to cook. And the other lads stayed over in the tended area. Anyway, company commander came back at quite late. I'd guess it was 0500, 1800 about, it, or 17 or 1800. Came back and said, the brigadier won't allow me to disband 6th platoon. He's going to send a sergeant up as a platoon commander and if you reform the platoon, he'll see you. He told me then he'd see me tonight, but as it happened, I didn't see him till the following morning. And I don't know whether we were pleased or sad, actually, because we were a bit proud that we'd been chosen to be the assault section, but didn't like to see 6th platoon disbanded. Anyway, 6 o'clock next morning, we form up because we're moving back up the line again, taking over for an American Airborne Regiment. And we haven't seen the CSM. We haven't seen any new platoon commander. Anyway, I was about, I guess, 0700, something like that, when he turned up. And he's a chap from Brigade. I think he was KSLI, or he might have been RWK badge, but he'd been with the KSLI. And it was obvious to me straight away that he had got the faintest idea what he was doing, because he formed us all up, which you'd expected him to do, and inspected and pulled people's bits and pieces about. And he formed a large, he took some guys from the sections and formed a larger platoon HQ. I just had a Sigma and myself, and now he formed, I guess he had about 4 guys and himself in platoon HQ, which of course has made the sections a bit smaller. And we loaded up one of the lorries and began to move off past the KOSB, who were out on an open area there. It was rather funny because one of them was going through bayonet fighting things, and of course he got a bit of a jeer from us, and they jeered us. And there was an MP there, and this is the first we've ever seen this. He's got the old white belt and the pistol and the lanyard and the old red cap on top, and they all shouted out to him, where's your air panel, mate? Where's your air panel? Because we'd never seen people with red caps before. Air's just... We couldn't tell them except they had MP on their arm. And he took it all good humouredly, and we went on. But eventually, we're dumped on the side of the road, form up, and start to march along the old tracks again. Very narrow tracks. The lorries had taken us as far as they could. And we get up onto a fairly low for Korea feature. I guess it was about a half a mile long, maybe, something like that. And it's overlooking a paddy fields and a road which is running literally across our front about, oh, I don't know, one place it's 900 yards, another place it's probably 400 yards ahead of us. And we dig it. We take over from some American airborne lads who've dug, well, as they don't ever dig proper slit trenches, and they dug these great big holes which they were wallowing about in. We had to redig. And I'd taken a chat with me. One of the lads was a little bit nervous. He'd been getting worse and worse. So I took him under my wing, and I started to put my LMG on my right flank to cover my right flank. And platoon sergeant came around and said, no, I want your LMG next to my platoon HQ. And I thought, that's a damn funny thing to do. So we had a little discussion about that, but he insisted. So we've now got the situation where the LMG's moved and the section commander and one man are on the right flank covering an open area, which didn't seem very wise to me, but, you know, everybody's got their own ideas. Anyway, we dig in quite well, actually. Quite easy digging. Unfortunately, I went off, came back, and my man has dug so deep we can't see over the top of the wretched trench. So the only thing I could do is dig another 2 foot out each end, which makes it a little bit long, and put some seats in, for want of a better word, and we could stand on the seats and see out, and the sump in the middle will take the water and things like that. But I don't know, he just wanted to get down below ground level as far as he ever could. He wasn't keen on doing any shooting anymore, poor old lad. Unfortunately, there's electric lines going over the top of us, those enormous, great big ones. And of course, that's not too good, because if anything bursts up in them, it'll spread down in us. So we might be glad of these deep trenches. Shortly after that, the Potemkin sergeant came around and said, "I've got trouble with two of the lads, two of your men." In fact, they were both in my section. He'd come along and taken two of my section, Ward and Nixon, two lads that were. Could be difficult to control if they didn't agree with what was going on. And he's got them and told them to dig a rocket launcher position right on top of a little mound. And they refused, just blankly refused. They wouldn't do it. And I hadn't seen any of this, you'll appreciate. He said, "Now look, I've given them a direct order. If they don't do it, I'm going to charge them." So I said, "Well, you know, go along. If you can get them to dig it, then I'll let it go." So I went and found them, and they said some rude words about the platoon commander, because he got the idea that they were going to dig right on this great big bare patch at the top, dig this rocket launcher position. It was quite the wrong place. I mean, it was ludicrous. I mean, any tank coming around the corner would have seen it and bopped it off before you could say Jack Robinson. So I thought, well, you've got to be pretty diplomatic about this. So I'd been told, incidentally, by the FFO who'd come up, that the range to the road junction, which was on our right flank, and where we joined up with the Americans, was 950 yards. Well, the range of a rocket launcher was 950 yards. So I went down to him and I said, "Look, I think you'd do better to dig this pit just behind your platoon HQ, and we know that's 950 yards over to that road junction, and if a tank was to come out round that corner there, you could fire this thing and you'd drop it probably into the turret." I mean, there wouldn't have hope in hell. I mean, 50 yards is the range of a rocket launcher, really, but for effective fire. But he thought it was quite a good idea. I said, "Then you can control it." And I gave him a bit of the old palaver, and he said, "Yeah, all right then. Dig it there." So all three of us then, and we dug a fantastic pit, nice big curve with a place for the rockets to lay out, and the rocket launcher in the middle. And he was absolutely delighted. And Nick and Wardy dug with a will. Now they'd got their way, and it wasn't up on the top there. And I said to him, "Well, look, the reason we don't want it up on the top there is if you've got us damped down the back of the rocket launcher." This was a training gimmick, in actual fact. If you damped down the back, it didn't throw up any dirt and dust. I mean, you could never damp down the back, and it had always been pretty damp up to now. But he thought it was a good idea, so he took that on. But unfortunately, of course, from then on, he passed most of his orders to the sections through me, you know, on this, you know, if they don't do it, then I'll charge them a bit. And of course, he obviously went down a bit in the estimation of people. The next day, wire came up, and we're going to lay a barrier of wire across the front, right across the front of all the positions there. And I've been having a great interest in the First War always since I was about, I don't know, 8 or 9 or something like that. I got this tape straight away, and we got working on the pickets, got a line of pickets out, and then short ones out to the front. And we got a lovely big V of wire, and we worked very, very hard. Didn't stop for meal or anything like that. Just people went back and had a brew, and we really got this canopy of wire across our front by evening. Very nearly finished by evening, and of course he was as pleased as punch with that, because we always thought ours was the best wire canopy put out. The next day, order came that we were to put another canopy in front of that, and I was quite pleased with that, because I'd been out front and I'd realised by taking a detonator out of a grenade and just throwing a dummy grenade up that you could reach, just about reach the trenches. But the second barrier, I measured out, and it was, the Chinese are not, haven't got a very good throw anyway. We're better throwers than them. And they wouldn't, the grenades wouldn't reach the trenches. And then in front of that, I put a single strand of wire, two single strands of wire, we've got some left over, and the view that it might trip people up or it would be uncomfortable as they tried to crawl up and things like that. And we had a fantastic wide in position. Unfortunately, I had a complaint then from the, we had to put a patrol forward. I didn't have to go out on the patrol at all, but we put a post rather forward in advance of everything else along a little spur to give warning of anybody coming up the spur and attacking us. And it was a bit of a nasty place to be, because there was very little chance that they had got out of it alive. They'd have given a warning and that would have been, they'd never got back, because either we'd have shot them or the Chinese would have shot them. But one of them came back and said to me, come and look at this. And I went out to see it, and the platoon sergeant had unfortunately wired it in, but he wired it in completely, or at least he'd allowed the lads there to wire it in completely. And they were completely wired in, and they had to climb out over the wire at the back. So I did a bit of reorganising there and got them a route out. And then I wound some wire, there's some trees there, I wound wire around the trees forward of them and took it up quite high, you know, about 6 foot high, and made a quite nice little mass, and they were reasonably safe there. But I must say that was a very nasty place to be. I wouldn't have wanted to be out there at all. But they decided it should just be a lance corporal and two men out there. I used to feel sorry for them out there. Anyway, platoon sergeant was quite pleased. I went back to him and said to him, look, I've made a few alterations out there. He said, oh, silly fools, I never intended them to do that. And I don't suppose he did. I bet he didn't. They just got carried away with their wire. We had a quiet night. And word came up that we were to dig sleeping pits behind the trench. We'd never done this before. But the new brigadier wanted sleeping pits dug behind the trenches. I must admit, we paid more or less lip service to it. We just dug the surface off and didn't go down very far, because we got our bivvies on the top, just literally on the reverse slope of the hill. And it began to rain again, incidentally, now. And of course, it was very, very heavy rain came down, started to fill the trenches up and things like that. We had to bail a fair bit. And I must say, the sleeping quarters were not very popular. Eventually, we had to dig them out. We had to dig sleeping quarters at the back. We never used them, because it just made the slit trench, which was lovely and narrow to start with, it just made it so big, because there were no materials to roof it in. Although they had materials sent up during this time, during this fortnight, to build a company HQ one, which was logged over on the top and was quite a smart sort of thing. And a couple of KSLI from their advance party came up, a couple of corporals came up to see what it was all about, and they stayed with Company HQ. And also a machine gun section came up from, I thought it was from the KSLI, but obviously it wasn't, they weren't there then. It was from the KOSB. They came up, and we watched them coming up the back slope there with all their kit and what have you. They moved their guns up into position. Major Allen, incidentally, at this time, he's coordinating all the machine guns of the brigade, because being a machine gun officer, he's probably the only one left who knows anything about it. So he's been away for a while, coordinating the Canadian, Australian and our own MMGs. And these Cosby come up, bring their guns up and put them in position, and then go back down again. And of course, Major Allen's standing on the top watching them. They go back down again and start bringing their bedding rolls up. They've got a gun and one belt up the top there. So he waits till they get to the top, and he blasted them. And they dropped their bedding rolls, poor lads, and went down and got all their belts of ammunition and everything else up and dug their positions before they did anything else. And they probably learned a lesson, I guess, that you must get the guns and the ammunition up first before you start worrying about bedding. Bill came over to me and said, you know those bloody machine gunners, they pinched my 4.5, so... The 4.5, which had been the company commanders, that he wouldn't give me to let it go back. It had been nicked by one of the machine gunners. Anyway, things were fairly quiet now. And we had word that, I think this was about, I guess it was about the 10th or something like that. We'd been laying more wire, as much wire as we could. D Company were on our right down there, and A Company were behind us. I think probably only a platoon of A Company, but the rest of them were perhaps back over the hill. And we got word that we could send two men down from each section, an NCO and two men down from each section, back to battalion headquarters, where they go down about 10 o'clock in the morning and come back for stand two, and they go the rest of the day down there resting and washing and doing whatever is necessary. So I was chosen to go down with the first two from my section, went down, and there was John Swarbrick, who had been our platoon commander down there, and I think he was MTO then, funny enough. The battalion headquarters, most peculiar, I'd never seen it that before, because they were in tents, and they had long lines of tents, again, all in line out, you know, just if they were on parade. I'd never seen that before. And we weren't allowed to go into their lines. We were stopped at a little stream, and we were told that everything within, you know, maybe about 4 or 5 yards around this this little place where we could have a wash and a rest and what have you, was out of bounds. We weren't to go in the tent lines at all, and we weren't to speak to anybody. It was the most peculiar thing. Anyway, we had quite a nice day down there. I guess there was about six privates and three NCOs. And, of course, we saw John Swarbrick, had a good chat with him, and there was central cooking going on down there. The meals were put on separately for us. We didn't go with the battalion HQ thing. And looking over the tents, most peculiar, because they got big torches they were being issued with, big lamps rather, not torches, big lamps. Each tent had got a little lamp, so I expect that they were probably a bit keeping us out in case we went and nicked the map, the lamps, because obviously anything that was going, we always picked it up and borrowed it for ourselves. Had a nice time down there, went off back, and I was told that I could send two more down the following day. I said to my lad who was with me, "Would you like to go down tomorrow?" And he said, "No." I said, "Well, come on, it'd be a nice day for you down there." It was, the weather's nice, incidentally, now. We're getting rain, and then we're getting nice days. Shirts off weather sort of thing. And he said, "No, I can't." So I thought, "Well, what do you mean you can't?" He said, "Well, I'll be quite honest with you. If I go down, I'll never come back." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I won't come back. They'll never get me back. I'm finished, and you know, this is my last lot as far as I'm concerned." And we didn't know what, you know, how long we were going to be in Korea. He said, "If I go down, I'll never come back." And I admired him. I thought that was very, very brave, to be quite honest, because he was at the end of his tether, but he was determined not to leave us. He knew that if he went, he just refused to come back up the line again. So he didn't go down, in actual fact, so I sent another couple down. And it was very, 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 very good lad he was. He wasn't much good, actually, because, I mean, most of the time he kept his head down, but he was determined not to leave. And we got the word then that we're going to advance the next morning, which seemed a bit stupid. We made these magnificent positions, and we heard that there was the army commander put battalions forward to try and draw the Chinese onto them, but they hadn't attacked, so now the whole army is going to go forward again, leave these wonderful defensive positions and go forward. But we stood to the next morning and with all our equipment on, what have you, ready to move, but it didn't come off, and at about 1100 we were stood down. And I think this is probably, it's probably the next day. That night we got the word that the KSLI had arrived at Incheon, and we were leaving the following morning, and I guess that would have been the 12th probably. And we were rather pleased at this, naturally. The Aussies were going to take over from us. Just before last light, the most peculiar thing happened. We saw a group of people coming with a flag down the place on the road junction between us and the Americans. Quite a group, I guess there was 50 of them, waving this big flag. We couldn't make out what was on the flag, but it looked like a UN flag. And they marched down through in the direction of battalion headquarters. Another company overlooked them, so we couldn't see who they were. But I should think they must have been rocks. But they were going down the path. It was the only path that wasn't mined, because they've been laying mines out in front of us. The whole area that was mined, and you really couldn't send out patrols at night. You didn't know where the wretched mines were, so we really stayed around the position, which was a bit unusual for us because we were always patrolling all over the place. Anyway, that night settled down, and suddenly from the Canadian area we heard heavy machine gun fire, and we were told that what they were doing, they had a bit of open ground, and presumably Major Allen had decided that this should be covered by medium machine gun fire during the period of darkness, and that they fired virtually all night long. And I don't know what time it was, it might have been about 2 o'clock in the morning. There were four shots fired from over four platoon, and we all stood to instantly. And we thought it was a Bren. We later found out it was a chap who actually went off to the SAS later. He'd fired four rounds of a rifle so fast that it sounded like a Bren gun. And what had happened, they think, was he'd heard this movement, and they think it was a deer, a small deer, because it had come up sounding like a person creeping up the hill. He'd fired at it and it ran off, so they realised it was some sort of animal. Next morning the Aussies came up and they were taking the mickey out of us, who was firing all night long. We said, well, it was the Canadians. They said, no, you lot down there, who fired that Bren? So it wasn't a Bren, it was a rifle. So these were new Aussies, I might say. The old lot are gone. There were very, very few of the old gang are gone, the ones that we, you know, sort of learnt to live with very comfortably. But these are new guys, out about, one of them had only been out about 3 or 4 weeks or something like that. Because I was saying to them, well, I'm sorry that we're off and sort of leaving you in the lurch. He said, well, I don't want to go, I've only just come. And they started filling their trenching, incidentally, because they couldn't see over the top either. Even by standing on, they were a couple of shorties, and even by standing on the seats we dug at the end, they couldn't see over the end. And we started to go down the hill, picking all their kit up, their bedrolls and what have you. We had to carry them back down to Battalion HQ. As we were marching away, from one of the Australian company that was behind us, there was a shout of, what's the score? And we suddenly realised there must be a test match or something on in Australia. So we called back, you know, we're winning. And they said, no, you're bloody well not. So I wasn't interested in sports, and I don't know anything about it. So I could only guess that that there was a test match going on, and no doubt we were losing. I can't remember. Anyway, we went off down, got on transport, and went to a riverbed, the usual old riverbed, and got the bivvies down and started to clear all the stuff out that we couldn't take with us. And they were throwing away flags and blankets and coats and goodness knows what else. Just over the other side of the river was a big battery of American long toms, 155s on armoured carriers. I think they were National Guard or something. They just arrived out there. They weren't firing. They were in position, but were not firing. And we get great heaps and fires going and things like that. But now we learned for the first time that not everybody was coming back with us. Unless they'd been there 6 months, they weren't coming back with us. So poor old Biggie and the guys who'd arrived in March, he'd arrived at Christmas. Charlie Mart, of course, had gone wounded. And Biggie was the only one of that lot left. And they'd got to stay behind, as had John Swarbrick. A very, very sad occasion, that, because it was a shock for them. They thought they were coming back with us, and they had to stay behind and go with the KS&I. In fact, Biggie was wounded later, and another one of the others shot in the legs. Shell fragments in the legs. Great pity, that. I mean, I can understand the March chaps, but those have been out since Christmas. Well, in fact, since November, really, because, I mean, they've been in Japan from November to December and then come out to us.